Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
In 2013, the National Research Council issued a stunning estimate. About 80% of sexual assaults in the United States are never reported to law enforcement. You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. When you consider the trauma victims have already endured, it is understandable that some are reluctant to call police. But it means that the overwhelming majority of rapists go unpunished. And it puts into perspective the extraordinary courage of a young woman like Monica Cora, who was kidnapped and raped by three strangers in 2009 when she was in her sophomore year as a scholarship athlete at SMU. Cora reported the attack to police, testified against her rapist in court, and went on to go public about her ordeal and found a victims' advocacy organization. Monica Cora shares her story of trauma and how she rebuilt her life in its wake in her new memoir, Kill the Silence, A Survivor's Life Reclaimed. She's in town for an event tonight at 6:30 at Moody Coliseum on the SMU campus and a book signing Saturday at 2 at the SMU Barnes & Noble on Mockingbird Lane in Dallas. Monica, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
How did you discover how much you love to run?
Oh, wow. Oh, that's a long time ago I discovered that. I started running and skiing from when I was a young girl, probably 3 or 4 years old. That's when I started. And I just, no, I loved it all my life. It's a normal part of my day. I have to go out there and run, yeah.
And the training, I guess, was part of certainly your physical health, but also it kept you mentally strong because you had to figure out how to deal with adversity probably on a daily basis.
Absolutely. No, that's what I think. All kinds of exercise. It's not only the physical benefit, but the mental benefit as well. And I've felt that my whole life, how I need running or exercise in my life to just stay healthy mentally and physically. And I think that gave me a lot of tools in life. I learned a lot by being an athlete. So, yeah, no, it's great.
What did you know about Dallas before you came to SMU to run and study?
Yeah, well, not much, to be honest. When I heard Dallas, I pictured people in the streets with big fancy hats on their horses riding down the street. That's what I pictured. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of surprised when I first came here and saw the highways and the billboards and tall buildings. I was.
And then it took you a while, like it does for a lot of freshmen new to school, to sort of find your way at school.
Oh, it did. It did. You know, when I heard that I was coming over here, I came on a scholarship to run, you know, so that was my focus. I came because I wanted to become a professional runner. And I was so excited, so I don't think I even thought about the studies and that I didn't know the language well or that I wouldn't have my family or friends around. So it was a big transition at first, it was.
How did you find a home, I guess, first with your team and your coach and then sort of to a greater extent at SMU?
Right. No, that's the thing. When I came to SMU the first day, my teammates, my coach took care of me. So I came into a family right away. So that really helped me through the first weeks. That was challenging. And I think just Dallas, like how people are so friendly and want to help out, that was the thing that really made me want to stay in this city, even though it was tough at first.
So did you have a sense that your speed and your strength, even though you're not physically a large woman, did you have a sense that that made you sort of invincible?
I don't know about that, if it made me invincible, but I think with running, that's kind of my way to just escape from everything else. I feel like I go out in my own little perfect world when I go running. So I think it gives me strength in that sense.
And then you had this attack that made running seem really scary, or at least running outside.
That's right. Yeah. No, when that happened, I was scared of everyone, scared of strangers, scared to go out by myself, even with friends around. It changed my whole world, basically.
You're very candid about this in the book. You speak about the attack, so I trust that you won't mind me asking you your memories. The night that you were attacked, when did you first realize something was wrong, that there was someone nearby who intended to do you harm?
Well, that was when they grabbed me. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize until that point. It was a good night. We were with one of my classmates at his apartment, a lot of athletes that got together before Christmas. And as we were walking out, one of our friends came to pick us up. And I thought everything was fine. I was ready to go back home to sleep. I was tired. And we went down to his car, three of us, three girls, hand in hand, skipping, running to his car because it was so cold outside. And suddenly I heard some screaming. And I thought it was someone that just asked for directions. But the next second I had someone grabbing me from behind and I had a gun next to my head.
And you were separated from your friends.
That's right. That was the thing. They had the gun. My friends, they tried to pull me towards them to save me. But then they pointed the gun towards them. So we had nothing we could do. We had to let go.
You were attacked by three men.
That's right.
And even in the disorienting situation, you were able to really distinguish one from the other in terms of their temperament. There was one you called the boss, there mm-hmm. was one you called the worst one, and there was one you called the weakest one.
Yeah. No, it didn't take me long to feel their energy. One of them was really aggressive and kind of the one that was in control. That was the way I saw it. And just the way they looked at me. One of them really looked at me and he seemed sorry or scared himself. He was able to meet my eyes, but the two others didn't. One of them just stared like straight through me. And that was the thing that scared me the most. Like I couldn't see a person in him. I tried to convince them to see me, that I was a person, that I wasn't just garbage that they could treat like that. But he didn't meet my eyes.
The one who did meet your eyes, mm-hmm. in some ways you say you hated him more in the moment because you knew or you had the sense that if he hadn't been put up to this,
yeah.
he wouldn't have touched you.
Exactly. No, and just it made me feel like he was weak because I felt like he kind of wanted to stand up for me, like he wanted to say something, but he didn't dare to. And it made me angry. So maybe that was a good thing that it kind of brought out some emotions in me. But no, it just made me sad and angry at the same time because I understood that he didn't feel like this was the right thing to do, but still he was unable to stand up for me.
Were you afraid they would kill you?
I was. That was my focus the whole night. Where is the gun? Where is the gun? And that was the thing that I said over and over. I just begged, please, please don't kill me.
I think a lot of people, at least in the abstract, can imagine how terrifying, how humiliating, how painful it is to be raped. One thing that really took me by surprise was the fact that the humiliation and the fear doesn't end when you get to a place of safety. When you got to Parkland Hospital, uh-huh. it was very clinical. There was just not a lot of compassion.
No. And that's the hard thing in a situation like this. The trust that you have in the world and people, it changes. And suddenly you don't trust anyone. And right after, of course, I was in shock still. So I didn't think clearly. But still, I just wish that someone had met me, my emotional needs at that point. Because I felt like it was more of a police case. They had to solve this case and they had to do A, B, and C, but I felt like I needed someone to be there for my emotional support. Maybe all that I needed was a hug, someone to hold my hand.
There was one nurse who seems to have seen you for the human that you are.
It was. She saved me that night. I have to say that. She saw me in the hallway and she just stopped and she stared at me and she asked me, what is going on? It looks like you're freezing. What are you doing here by yourself? And she asked me if I needed a blanket. And I just said, yeah, I think I need a blanket. So she ran off and came back with two blankets, covered them around me. And I just grabbed her and just held her. And she gave me a hug at that point. And that's what made me feel safe. And that gave me the strength to fight through that night.
How were you released from the car after your attack?
Well, I don't know how long it was, but they were driving. And suddenly, at one point, they placed duct tape around my head, covered my eyes. And they opened the door and they pushed me out.
And they yelled at you to run, so mm-hmm. you can't see anything. How did that happen?
Yeah, they pushed me out and they told me to run. Well, at that point, I couldn't even stand up. I tried, of course, to get on my feet because I was scared that they would come after me. And they did. One of them came after me and pushed me towards the ground. At that point, like, I didn't realize why. I didn't know if they were about to shoot me at that point. But the reason why they came back after me and pushed me was because I had my phone in my hand. So they came back after that. But then they pushed me and they told me to run. And I just heard the car took off. And that was it.
What else was in that car besides your three attackers and the duct tape?
Mm-hmm. The other women's shoes.
Other women's shoes.
Yeah. And that was the thing, I think, that gave me the final strength to really just stick or be able to fight my way through this. Because I got angry at that point. Before that, I think I was just sad and I was just scared to lose my life. But when I saw those shoes, I realized that these men have probably done this before. And that gave me the strength to just fight through it, because that's when I realized, you know what? I have to survive this and I have to stand up for other people so that no one else would experience what I experienced that night.
So you are out there alone. You don't have your clothes fully back on. I guess you're holding the dress that you'd been wearing. And you're blindfolded with this duct tape. How did you find help?
Well, it took a while because at that point I was in shock and I was scared. So I was kind of just lost. All I wanted was to find my way back home, but I didn't know where I was. So I think I just started running in circles. But after a while, I realized that I need help. It was freezing outside. So first I knocked on some doors, but no one opened. I mean, it was in the middle of the night, so that's understandable. So I started running towards the road again, and I tried to approach cars. But at that point, too, I was so scared, so I was just running back and forth. As soon as I saw a car coming, I tried to find the strength to just stand there and ask for help. But I took off running in the opposite direction because I was too scared that it was someone else that would come after me. But after a while, I realized, you know what, I need to just find the strength, stand here, ask for help. But that was probably the most shocking part about that night. People just passed me. Cars passed me. People looked at me and they just passed.
What do you think they were thinking?
I don't know. I think they were probably scared to get in trouble themselves.
So eventually, police found you. Mm-hmm. You weren't absolutely sure you could trust them.
No, I wasn't at that point. Well, it was. I had a helicopter above me. I had probably 20 police cars coming out. But still, it was something that just told me that you can't trust anyone at this point. So I asked them to prove to me that they were police officers, but still, I didn't trust them. But I remember that I asked for a female officer. And when a female officer came, I was able to calm down and finally talk to them.
And the reason the helicopter was there, your friends, at the moment you were grabbed, immediately called 911.
They did. And they tried to chase after the car. They tried to find me, but they took off too fast. But they actually met police officers at the gas station just a few minutes after. So radio signals went out right away that I was missing. So the police did a great, great job.
Did you have the sense while you were being attacked that somebody was probably looking for you, or did you feel completely alone?
No, you know, I didn't. I felt like there was something present there in the car that night too. Something that just told me to hold on and that this would end soon. So I had this mental battle kind of inside my head that one part of me was just so scared to die. But the other part of me just told me that, no, you know what, you'll survive this.
My guest is Monica Cora. She's an SMU graduate and founder of the trauma victims advocacy organization known as the Monica Cora Foundation. She's the author of a new memoir as well called Kill the Silence, A Survivor's Life Reclaimed. She will have a book signing event on Saturday that takes place at SMU's Barnes & Noble at the Mockingbird Lane there at SMU. And this evening at 6:30 at Moody Coliseum on the SMU campus, she will be speaking. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, or you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Fall registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Monica Cora, founder of the Monica Cora Foundation and author of the new book, Kill the Silence, A Survivor's Life Reclaimed. It's a story about how she survived a rape and then went on to testify against her attackers and found an organization to provide advocacy for people who have been victims of sexual trauma. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. You get through the night. You finally get home. You're exhausted. You feel awful. Something people may not realize is that when you have been raped and you go to the hospital, you are prescribed all kinds of medication. You didn't know if you'd been exposed to HIV. You didn't know if you'd been impregnated. And so you have to deal with all of that on top of just sort of, you know, getting to sleep and trying to get through the next few days.
Right, right. And that was the thing when you're already so weak. You haven't slept, you haven't eaten, and you don't want to eat. You don't want to sleep, and you have to take all this medication. It makes you really weak. So I was really sick for a few weeks there after.
You had to call your parents and tell them what had happened. And the thought of that and knowing that your pain is going to instantly become their pain is just hard to imagine.
Yeah. No, that, I think that was the hardest thing of it all, knowing that I had to call them. My coach, actually, he offered to call for me, but I just knew, no, I have to do that myself. I knew that it would be awful for them to have someone else to call them and tell them about this. So I knew that I had to call them and reassure them that I was fine, that I was still alive. But it took me a long time to do that. I know that I dialed a number over and over, and I just tried to figure out what to say so that it wouldn't sound so bad. But I mean, there's really no good way to tell parents about something like this. So I knew that I just had to go ahead and tell them the truth about what had happened. So I did that. But I was, of course, so scared about how they would take that, sitting on the other side of the world back home in Norway. But I told them. And the way they responded to me, it took me by surprise too. We shouldn't have, because I know they're strong. But they just told me right away that, Monica, you know what? We're in this together. You're not alone. And that was the first time I actually thought that I would be able to fight through this.
And they said to you, not in a way that was unkind or dismissive, they said, you are incredibly strong and you're going to be fine.
Yeah, they did. They did. And that's the thing. My mom, she's always told me from when I was young that whenever you fall off the horse, get right back on. And that was kind of the thing that they said then too. We know that you're strong. We've known you your whole life and you're a fighter. So you're going to make this, but we're in it together.
They wanted to come immediately, as any parent would, to be with you. And you said, no, I'll be home for Christmas in a few days.
Yeah.
Let me just come home on my own. Why did you make that decision?
I know it's hard for people to realize why I wanted it to be that way. But I think at that point, first of all, I just felt like I had to take care of everything. I had to call my professors and make sure that I would be able to complete my classes. I had to follow up with the police. I have to follow up with the hospital, see that everything was fine. So I was just in this mode. I had to do this and that. And I don't think I wanted any distraction at that point. To me then, too, it was about the police case. We needed to find them. We needed to make sure that they got into prison. So I think I was just so focused. And also, maybe I was scared that if they would come, I would probably break down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When you did get home, you and your sister slept in the same bed every night. You felt safer with her there.
I did. Absolutely. Because that was the hard part for me in the beginning, to be alone. I didn't dare to be alone. So when she came into the room that first night, that just meant everything to me.
And then during that holiday break, when everybody else, I guess, was partying and taking a break, you're taking stock of your whole life. There had to be a reckoning. You have this relationship with your body as this thing that has done what you wanted it to do, that you could push and challenge. And it's still your body and it's still you. And yet it has been violated
by
someone.
Yeah. No, and I have to say that it took me a while to love my body again. I know my whole life that my body's doing great things for me. It takes me out running, skiing, doing the things that I love every day. But at this point, I kind of have to start over and figure that thing out in a new way. But that was the thing that made me feel in control of my own body and made me love it again. That was sports, realizing that that's what my body can do for me. And it gave me the mental strength that I needed.
Anybody would have understood if you had never gone back to school, at least at SMU. Mm.
No, I had to do that. That was one thing that I made that decision before I went home to Norway for that Christmas break. I made the decision, if you're getting on the plane now, you're going back to Norway to celebrate Christmas with your family, you have to make the decision that you will be back here in January. So that was a decision that I made in December. And I was just going to hold on to that. Because I knew that if I would go home and if I would just stay at home, I probably would have been scared of everything. I probably wouldn't have been able to travel and it would have set me back in life. And I didn't want that. Even though that I knew that it would be a challenging time when I came back, I think it was so much better for me to try to go back to normal life, even though I would be mentally and physically tired for a while, than to just hide. I would have been scared, broken for life.
You had a friend who said, hey, let's go running. And you said, it's too cold out, which you knew didn't sound realistic for a girl from Norway. But she said, okay, let's go to the gym. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the first running was on a treadmill.
It was. And she understood. She knew me. She knew that I wanted to be strong, but she also saw through that. Mm-hmm. So she realized that, okay, I'll just tell her, yeah, let's go on the treadmill. And we did. The first run was tough. I think I stayed on the treadmill for 10 minutes. But still, it gave me strength, you know, because it constantly reminded me of who I am and who I wanted to be. And that's the thing that's been important for me, to not let what happened to me change who I am. My identity, I'm an athlete. I'm not a victim.
Are you just known as a force of nature everywhere you go? Because the things that you have said, you have so much determination. Lots of people want to do things that are strong and resilient, but struggle. It seems like you make a decision and it happens by sheer force of will.
Well, yeah, no, I think it's a lot about making decisions in life, for mm-hmm. sure. And to just work hard. I think I'm used to that from being an athlete. Set goals and work to achieve them. Yeah.
Was it helpful to you that your coach did know from the beginning what had happened to you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because he was there to help me right away. And he didn't push me. He knew right after that this was about me taking back my own life first, and then it would be about getting back on the track. So that I had his support and that he set me as a person. He saw me as a person and not only his athlete. And that was important to me. He really showed me that he cared about me as a person.
Is that something that happens everywhere, or do you think you got lucky to be where you were?
I hope it happens everywhere. And I think it does. I think it does. When something like this happens, I think we realize that life is about more than athletics or the things that we do in everyday life. So I think we really care about the people around us when something like this happens. Yeah.
I was really shocked by that figure that I mentioned at the beginning of the show, that 80% of rapes go unreported. You quote a figure in the book that says something like 15 out of 16 rapists go unpunished. They never
exactly.
see a day in jail. Even though you could never have considered not reporting the crime, can you understand how it is that victims feel like they can't report?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's a thing in society. You know, we tend to blame the victim. We ask, what were you doing out at night? What were you wearing? Had you been drinking? We ask all of these questions that leaves the blame on the victim. And it's never the victim's fault. Rape is a horrible crime. And I think people need to understand that if it's an acquaintance rape, if there's someone that you know and that you trusted, I think it's even worse. Because then you lose the trust in people that you're surrounded by. And it might be even harder to ask for help. So I think, no, I understand it. Absolutely, I do.
Tell us about the process of preparing for the trial, because you had to sit there, you had to tell your story again in just excruciating detail, and you had to sit for cross-examination.
Yeah. So the first trial started about a year after it all happened. And it was a long year.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted it to start right after. But thinking back at it, and that it took a whole year, I think that was good for me, because I really got to prepare for it mentally. And I went over like how that trial would be in my head over and over and over before that day came up. So I think I was ready for it. You know, I had prepared for it mentally for a long time. But it was tough. And in some ways, I couldn't prepare for all of it. I could picture the room. I could kind of figure out what kind of questions I would be asked. But what I didn't know was how I would respond to seeing them again. And that was the thing that scared me the most.
What was that like?
You know what? I felt empowered in that courtroom. Because I felt like that day I took the control back. I felt stronger. I was looking down upon them then. They looked scared. They feared what was about to happen. And I was there to reclaim my life. So I think it empowered me.
Did you feel like a new surge of anger at them, seeing them once again?
I don't think I felt anger. No. It just made me sad, you know? And in court, two of them had their families with them. And that was the thing that just made me really sad, realizing that they had a family and just picturing what they probably had done to their families. I spent one night with them, their families, their wives, their kids. Has spent every day for years with them. So it just made me sad.
What did you want them to understand about what they had done to your life?
Yeah, that was the thing that was important to me, for them to really understand what they had done to me. Because they avoided those words. Rape, they avoided that. And that was the thing that was important for me, to make them understand they had raped me. And that that was a horrible crime. Because I think for anyone to change, you need to understand what you have done. So that was the thing that was important to me. Realize that you had harmed me in a brutal, horrible way.
Do you think they understood?
Two of them did. Not the third one. The third one had the same just blank stare that he had in the van that night. Looked straight through me. The whole trial. The other two, they cried. They looked at me and they asked for forgiveness.
Did the defense of your attackers bother you? The fact that people tried to make a case for their innocence?
You know what? First it did. And I know I've mentally prepared for this trial. And in my head, I was thinking to myself that I'm going to look at him. I'm going to stare at him and make him feel bad for me. But when I looked at him, I saw a person, you know? And I think he felt sorry for me too. I think it made him uncomfortable to ask me all those questions. So I realized there that he was there doing his job. So it kind of, I had to change my strategy on that.
You made a statement to your rapist.
I did, yeah.
What did you tell them?
I told them that I would forgive them if they promised me to change, if they promised me to work on their life while in prison to become a better person, especially the one that got 25 years. It's so important for me to know that he will be a better person when he's let back out. We know that he will be back out in society one day. And we have to make sure that he will be different so that he won't hurt anyone again. And for me, that was about trying to give him some hope, you know, that he will, that he has something in him that will make him able to turn around and become a better person.
What did you gain from making the decision to not hold on to your hatred?
I think that freed me from all of it. That was the time when I was finally able to let all of it go. Because forgiveness to me, it's not about accepting what they did to me or liking them in any way. But it's my inner peace. I find inner peace by letting all of this go.
You were, in the early days, to be clear, afraid that you might never get over this. You are so strong and you come across as so together right now that I don't want to leave people with the impression that you were not devastated. You had nightmares. You were afraid to do a lot of things. As you said, you hated your body or didn't love your body for a while. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about when you weren't so sure that you would get better?
Oh, yeah. No, that for months, I was scared that I would be like that for the rest of my life. Because I didn't feel in control of things anymore. And I felt like I was about to lose it. I didn't recognize myself. I had anxiety. I felt depressed. I couldn't sleep at night. And when I finally slept, I had nightmares. So it took over my life. And it took a while. It took me months. It probably a few years until I felt like I really found back to a happy, good life. So it was tough. I'm not going to lie. Of course it was. I've cried many tears. I've been angry. but it is possible to work through it.
There's also this strange thing that a trauma like this does to your relationship with the good people in your life, the people who love you, who I gather are not quite sure what to do with you, how to help you, how to let you know they care about you. You didn't want to be smothered.
No, that was the thing for me too. I was just scared that this would be the focus of my life and other people's lives. I wanted people to move on with their lives in a way. And I just felt like everyone was focusing too much on me and that it took away from their lives. And I think also a lot of people are so scared of not saying the right things mm-hmm. or not doing enough. And that's just what I want to remind people, that it's not about saying the right things. I had a psychologist that I could talk to that could tell me what I needed to do and tell me what I felt like, how I would feel like, and try to guide me through the process. My friends, that wasn't what they had to do. They just had to be there for me like they had been before. And I think that's so important to remember when we stand next to someone that experience a challenging time, that just be there like you've always been. Just show that you are there to support and listen.
Were there people who went away because they couldn't bear your pain?
It was. I had a group of friends, and that made me realize that I don't think they knew how to deal with it. And instead of just being there, they went away. They didn't want to see me because they were scared to say something wrong. And that's just the thing that's the most painful of it all. It's so much better to be there. And to say something silly, that's fine, but just be there.
My guest is Monica Cora. She's an SMU graduate and founder of the Monica Cora Foundation. Her new memoir is called Kill the Silence, A Survivor's Life Reclaimed. She'll speak tonight at 6:30 at Moody Coliseum on the SMU campus. And there's another event taking place on Saturday at the Barnes & Noble at Mockingbird Lane in Dallas. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can email think@kera.org. You can call 1-800-933-5372 or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd. Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with SMU graduate Monica Cora, founder of the trauma victims advocacy organization, the Monica Cora Foundation, and author of the new memoir, Kill the Silence, A Survivor's Life Reclaimed. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. Monica, in this country, we try to protect the identity of sexual assault victims. You were given like a code name for the trial. Your name was not released to the media. You could have gone on with your life and had only the people that you chose to tell know about this. Why did you want the story out there and want your name attached to this?
Mm-hmm. No, because I think it's so important. You know, the guilt and shame that's often connected to rape. We need to stop that. It's not the victim's fault. And that was the thing that I just felt like I need to fight for that. I need to kill the silence. We need to start to talk about this because I didn't want anyone in this world to experience what I experienced.
Did you find when you started to do this that people would approach you and tell you their stories that they had not told people before?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Every time I speak, when I go out to speak at colleges or different events, every time I have someone that comes up to me and tell me about their experience. And it makes me sad, but it also a good thing because I know then that they're able to talk about it. And I know that there's a lot of healing in that.
It takes a strong heart to absorb all that from other people.
Yeah, it takes, sometimes I need to just go home, go for a run or try to get all of the negative feelings away. But I know that it's necessary to talk about it. And I want to be there. I want to be of help for others.
What do you think we could do to change the way we care for sexual assault victims in the aftermath?
No, I think we just need to start to talk about it, address it as an issue, and to really realize it's never the victim's fault. Always start by believing.
There's also the concern I think that some victims have that, and it's something that I know that you struggled with, that people would always sort of see this as an element of who they were and sort of have this in the back of their mind. I don't know about Norway and America. We have weird thinking about sex in all ways. And did you worry at all that somehow people would meet you and think, oh, there's the girl who was raped?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I worried about that for a long time. I really did. And I think that was the thing that I struggled with for a long time, for years, that I just wanted to prove to people that I wasn't broken, that I was no victim. And running was the thing that gave me strength in that sense. And I was able to, at one day, to tell myself, you know what, I'm not a victim, I'm a runner. I've always been a runner, I always will be a runner.
You run with headphones in or anything?
No, normally not. Nope. I just like when I go out and just de-stress and run into my own little perfect world. It's a way to clear my mind. So I don't like to listen to music.
I was wondering, like, what you think about, if there's something about when you get into that rhythm that is going to take you over several miles, what yeah. happens in your brain?
You know, I solve all kinds of problems when I'm out running. I really do. No, that's the thing. It clears my mind. Mm-hmm. It makes me think about things in a good way, in a positive way. So often when I'm frustrated or angry, I just realize, okay, I need to put my running shoes on. I need to go out there. And after an hour, I'm sure I'll feel a lot better. And it happens every time. I feel a lot better after a good run.
So we were talking in the break. This book grew out of some journals that you started keeping that you actually gave to the prosecutor in arguing your case, just so that they would have an understanding
exactly
of things. Why did you start writing?
So I didn't have a book in mind when I started writing. I started writing just a few days after. For me, that was a way of just getting all of this out of my head. Because at first, I just felt like I kept all of it inside, and I didn't know how to deal with it all. So something just told me, well, write it down. So I did. Every detail, what they did to me that night, I wrote it down in a book. And that brought out a lot of emotions, I have to say. I started to cry. I felt angry. I felt sad. But it helped. I got the emotions out. So I understood that it's healing in it, in writing. So I continued to do that. So I wrote every day after, through it all, through the trials. And it helped me so much. And one day I just realized that, well, there's probably something in this that I can share with others that can be of help.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Lisa in Crowley. Hi, Lisa.
Hi there. Thank you for allowing me to call in. I wanted to thank you, Monica, for what you're doing as far as giving the information and putting support systems out there. And I'm sorry for what you went through. It's not an easy situation. I'm 51, and I was date raped twice, once directly after a car accident when I was 18, and then another time within about 5 years after that, and held hostage and things like that. Anyways, I'm not a victim to it anymore. What I'd like to say is that you're right, that there isn't a lot of support systems that are put out there. As far as, like, the one when she's reported it and taken to a hospital, there isn't that support mechanism. I didn't tell my mom or my family for about 15 years, until 15 years later, because I didn't have that support, and I knew that my mom would freak out. And so it wasn't available to me. I didn't even go to the hospital. Accident, and I was bleeding. So I just want to tell you, thank you. We do need more support out there, that these women, you know, need to be hugged and taken care of emotionally so they can get the strength to go through it.
Lisa, thanks so much for your call.
Thank you, Lisa. And thank you for sharing your story. I have to say, I'm sorry for what happened to you, but I'm happy to hear that you're doing good today. But I think they're really doing some amazing work out there today. I know that the hospital, they're improving. They're bringing the same programs into hospitals. They have a better network of support now than what they did a few years ago. So I want to just thank them. And in Dallas, they're doing a great job on that. So I think that they're really improving.
We should say that when you were leaving the hospital, your clothes had been taken into evidence. Mm-hmm. The same nurse who brought you the blanket brought you clothes from her own locker.
She did. She did. No, she was amazing. She saved me that night. And she told me. She went into her closet and she gave me a set of clothes. And she said, I've just kept this in my closet, so just take it. And then she gave me a plastic bag. And she told me, tomorrow, put this in the bag and throw it away. You don't want anything to remind you of this night.
And is that what you did?
That's what I did. And it felt good to do that, to just throw it away, to kind of just, yeah, rid myself of all of that. So that lady, oh, she brought me so much hope that night.
Have you met her again?
I haven't. I still want to meet her. But that's the thing. I don't even remember her name.
Hmm. Do you think she remembers?
I think so. I think so.
Tell us about the foundation, how you decided that you wanted to move from sort of helping people on a sort of one human scale, to moving that beyond to seeing what else you could do.
That's the thing. I needed to find a way to reach more people. That's why I started this organization, and to create awareness of the issue, a place where we can spread information, where we can host events to create awareness, and where we can help more victims than what I would be able to just do by myself without having this organization. So it's a lot about public speaking, reaching out to big groups, and I can see how that helps other people to open up, and that just, it gives all of this meaning when I'm able to do this. So I'm so grateful for what I'm able to do today.
When you encourage other people to think about telling their stories, I mean, you're not necessarily saying you need to go on the 6 o'clock news, you need to write a book. But there are people who haven't even told people they have really close relationships to.
Right, right. And yeah, I have to say that absolutely not. I don't encourage people to do what I'm doing. But I think you have to be ready for it, to open up to others. But just find one person that you trust, and start just by telling a little bit. Like I did by telling my story. I didn't tell it all right away. I started writing. And then I kind of went from the time where I met with the police officers a few days later. That's where I started to tell my story. And then I backed off from that. And then I told people about the experience at the hospital. And then I was able to tell people about that night and what actually happened to me. So I think you just need to feel when you're ready for it yourself.
Did your friends feel comfortable asking you questions in order to fully understand your story, or did they wait for you to volunteer information?
No, it was more about listening, sitting there listening and letting me guide the conversation. And I think that was such a good way to do it, because I never felt pushed to tell more than I was comfortable telling. So they were just sitting there and really listening. And when I felt like talking about something else, we would talk about something else. And then a few days later, I were able to tell a little bit more. So it's just baby steps. Yeah, one step at a time.
A lot of advocacy, certainly not all of it, about rape is about prevention. I don't know how you feel about that, because it sounds like you did everything right. You were with friends. You were, traveling in a group. You had sort of taken measures to be safe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think I did. But still, you know, it happens all over the world, every single day. And that's the sad truth. I don't want people to be scared because of that. We shouldn't walk around and be scared, but we can try to be as safe as possible. We should always walk with friends. And yeah.
What do you think makes you resilient?
Good question. Well, I think it's a lot about letting other people help, realizing that you're not alone. I got so much strength from family, from friends. And that's the thing that just, gives me strength every day.
Was there a moment where you thought, or your parents thought, we should never have let Monica go to the U.S.? Because as a parent myself, if my child was in a foreign country, I don't know if I would just assume that there was something wrong there, as opposed to this is a horrible thing that could happen to a woman or a man anywhere in the world.
No, I think that's one of the things that has been so good in my case, because my parents never saw it that way. Mm-hmm. I never saw it that way. I love Dallas, and I knew that I wanted to come back here. I wouldn't let those criminals steal that away from me. I loved SMU, the school that I went to, running, and all the opportunities that I was given. So I didn't want to give up on that. And my family supported me. Like, you have to go back. You have to follow your dream. Don't let anyone take that away from you.
So what specific, you said the foundation is a lot about you doing public speaking. What kind of advocacy are you focusing on right now?
Well, it is that public speaking and also following up. After I go speaking, a lot of people contact me. So for me, it's all about trying to do as much as I can, following up with other victims by email, by phone, by meeting them. So it's a lot on a personal level, to be honest. And that's the thing that gives me a lot, I think, to see that I'm able to help someone. And that's what gives me that motivation every day, too. If I can help one person, it's all worth it.
Do you remember a day when you woke up or looked up and thought, I'm doing better now? Or did that happen gradually?
Well, it happened gradually. It did. But I think it was a lot about when I was able to run again, mm-hmm. and when I was able to run fast again. One of the goals that I set after was that I needed to be just as strong physically and mentally as before. So setting a personal record, that was a big goal for me in the time after. And the day I was able to do that, that was the best feeling in the world. That was about 1.5 years after. And I was able to set a new PR in the 3,000 meter. And that was the day where I said, you know what? I've healed. I'm myself again. I feel like myself again.
Are you still competing?
I am. Love running. Yep.
Are you someone who just cannot stand to lose?
Yep. You got that right.
When you had the book finished and you, I guess, read back over it at least once during the editing process and all that, were you struck by how far you'd come? Were there things you didn't notice before that you thought, wow?
Yes, that's a good question. It is, because that's the thing. My book now, it kind of stands as a proof to me that I've healed. And sometimes, some days, I need to read the end of it again. And I say, you know what? I am doing good. So yeah, it's healing in that for me still now to look at that book and say, well, there it is. That's my proof. I've healed. I made it.
And there are still some tough days.
It is. Absolutely. It is. And especially working with it, seeing other victims, it can bring out a lot of emotions in me. But it's not so much about me anymore and what happened to me. I don't feel scared, or it's more about sometimes feeling angry because I realize that it still happens in the world. So it's all about that, the work that I'm doing. And sometimes I can get a little bit overwhelmed by it, but it also gives me strength to fight harder.
Monica Cora is a graduate of SMU and a founder of the trauma victims advocacy organization, the Monica Cora Foundation. She's author of a new memoir called Kill the Silence, A Survivor's Life Reclaimed. She will speak tonight at 6:30 at the Moody Coliseum on the SMU campus. Monica, it's been wonderful to have you here. Thank you for making this time for us.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered today by Alan Roberts. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.